On behalf of Lindenwood College, I'm Dr. James Spainhar, the president, and I want to welcome you here. We are honored to have Secretary Kissinger on our campus and Senator Danforth. Before I introduce Senator Danforth, I do want to present the president of our student body, Mr. Ron Waterman, if you'll stand and just wave. Ron is the originator of what we call Project Peace, which has resulted in an invitation from the Citizens Exchange Commission and also the Education Department of the Soviet Union for 15 of our young people to go to Soviet Russia on an exchange program next spring. And in January of this year, 15 students from the Soviet Union will be on our campus for a week, and previous to that, but they will be spending a week in Washington and in New York. So we thought it was particularly fitting with a man of the stature of Secretary Kissinger on our campus to make you aware of this fine exchange program in which our college is engaged. My friend Jack Danforth, you are a sneaky person. I am a clergyman, as is Senator Danforth. And clergymen usually are thought of as being rather sober and abstaining from any alcoholic drinks. And I'm a Democrat. And it's usually thought that I would not support a Republican, but I am strongly in support of Jack Danforth. I think it would be a shame for the state of Missouri to lose his services, and I encourage you to give him your full support. But here he does. He gets me out on an occasion like this and gets my picture taken between two very prominent Republicans holding a glass of wine in my hand. And I'm afraid that any kind of reputation that I've had has been blown all to hell. But Jack, I can't think of a better cause than your reelection as United States Senator. He's been a fine senator, and Lindenwood College, not officially, but at least through the voice of its president, is delighted to have you here tonight, and is delighted to have you, Senator Kissinger. Following Secretary Kissinger's presentation, he has agreed for some questions to be submitted to him, but we will be adjourning at 8:15. Now, my friend, but first, let me introduce his lovely wife, Sally Danforth, who indeed is a lovely person. And now our distinguished senior senator from Missouri, Jack Danforth. Senator Danforth.
Jim Spainhour, thank you very much, and let me assure you that Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker have already blazed the trail for you, so don't worry about a thing. I want to thank Jim Spainhour, my former colleague in state government. We served together, I as Attorney General and he as State Treasurer. Really a great person, and he's, I'm sure, done so much for this college. Thank him for his hospitality. Thank Lindenwood College for opening the doors to us tonight. And I also want to express my appreciation to those who helped put this together, the various members of the committee, and all of you who are here and who are helping my campaign by being here. I had the opportunity downstairs to thank you personally. I hope that I met most of you, if not all of you, but please take this as my genuine appreciation to each one of you for being here and for your financial contribution to the campaign. I am not going to make a speech because we only have about 40 minutes. And it's such a privilege, I think, for all of us to have Henry Kissinger here to give us a little substance. Most people go to a political fundraising event and there's absolutely no substance at all. I don't want this to be that way. I believe that foreign policy must be one of the key issues before the American people in this national campaign. I have served in the United States Senate and seen the United States Senate turn the foreign policy of America into hash. That is the present state of affairs. I have been on the floor of the Senate to see floor amendments offered almost literally on the back of envelopes, expressing the sense of the Senate on everything imaginable in foreign policy. I don't think we're speaking with one voice. I think it's the farthest thing possible from a bipartisan foreign policy. And I also believe that in this presidential campaign particularly, and certainly in the Senate campaign also for that matter, particularly in the presidential campaign, we have such a clear difference about the role of America in the world, the role of national defense, the potential of the United States to secure a more stable peace, that these issues really should be discussed and should be debated, should be aired publicly. And that is why I am especially happy that Henry Kissinger is with us tonight. He really needs no introduction. A truly outstanding person, one who's given so much to our country. Henry, thank you very much.
Jack, and ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate this introduction very much, and also that you sat down reasonably quickly, because it has been alleged that I have difficulty looking humble for extended periods of time. I will try to speak for about 15 minutes, and if I do, no matter what I say, you can all report that you were present at a historic occasion. And then I'll take a few of your questions. And then I have to run for an airplane, which I must make tonight. I have done fundraisers for a few senators who I think are absolutely crucial to the direction of the Senate and for their contribution to our nation. And Jack Danforth, who luckily doesn't need all that much help, is somebody who deserves recognition for his stance on national defense, foreign policy, the international position of the United States on trade, and many other crucial issues. Secondly, I've done a lot of fundraising, and politically speaking, for people who need a lot more help, namely on the national ticket, because I completely agree with Senator Danforth on two propositions. One, we can't continue to conduct foreign policy the way we've been conducting it. We are in the position of a chess player who plays chess with an opponent who does it in a normal way, making his moves, while we have to explain our moves publicly to 535 kibitzers who occasionally make a move for us, which, no matter how brilliant it may be, makes it impossible to have any coherent design. And secondly, I agree completely with the Senator that this election is about fundamental issues of the direction of American foreign policy. First, I'd like to make a few observations about the fact that we, in fact, have the most unusual opportunity in the conduct of our foreign policy in the entire post-war period. The opportunity resides not in the fact that Gorbachev is a nice guy. I think it is an illusion to equate foreign policy with psychiatry or even with theology, and to assume that our problems get solved by conversion. If you look at a system of government in which no Soviet leader has ever retired voluntarily, In fact, all of them have died in office, in which every Politburo that elected a general secretary has then been purged by the man whom they put into office, where when you lose your job, you lose everything, your apartment, your dacha, your access to stores, hospitals, vacation resorts, and so forth. That means that choir boys do not enter that career. Anybody who wants job security is running an electricity works somewhere in the Soviet Union. These are people with a tremendous sense for power. And I think that one of the achievements of Soviet foreign policy in recent years is to sell the proposition that we're dealing here with a superior human being who's going to solve all our problems for us. I think it's unlikely to begin with. But even if it were likely, even if you assume that he's benign, you have to remember that every Soviet leader has been disavowed by his successor, without exception. And therefore, we cannot base American foreign policy on one man. We have to base American foreign policy on a balance of the permanent interests of the United States with the permanent interests so that any Soviet leader would have to follow in the same direction. Now, Gorbachev does not pursue his present policy because he is really a Midwesterner at heart who has finally gotten into office. I have a friend who has the view that there is no such thing as an English accent, that the English put this on to intimidate Americans. If you can only catch an Englishman unawares, according to that friend of mine, like waking him up at 4 in the morning unexpectedly, he will speak like any other normal human being. That is often our attitude towards the Soviets. Now we found a Soviet who speaks like a normal human being. But I'd like to suggest to you that there are a number of realities that have driven the Soviets to this. One is that their economy is a total mess. In an economy in which everything moves by allocation, you reach the paradox that the attempt to make everything totally predictable and to plan everything causes this leadership to lose total control over what is going on. Theoretically, the planners are supposed to tell the managers what to do, and the managers are then supposed to give their product to the ministries. In fact, what happens is a collusion between all of them, because they know if their quotas aren't met, they all go down the drain together. So they set quotas that they know they can meet. And there's no kind of quality control because there are no markets. And there's no incentive for quality control. Everything that's produced is given to the ministries and then distributed. And somebody said the only question with the Soviet TV set is whether it explodes when you turn it on, whether it will work for any length of time. So it is a system that is inherently unworkable, and that they have caught on to. Most importantly, they have no idea what anything costs. The subway fares in Moscow are still the same as they were in the middle 30s. Now, you know this cannot be. So what they have to do is to do a price reform. But when they have a price reform, that means there'll be inflation, because that's the only way you can determine relative costs. That, in turn, will produce unemployment, which is the only way you can get rid of inefficient enterprises. And so the conservatives are always coming back in these quarrels as the defenders of the public against inflation and unemployment. And the public is not as unhappy as we Americans think, because while their standard of living is not very high, they have job security, and above all, they don't have to work very hard. The social contract in the Soviet Union is that managers don't manage and workers don't work. And so this is the fundamental problem that Gorbachev has. how is he going to make that system going, get it going? It's a state composed of many nationalities, always been highly centralized, no experience with decentralization. It's a state that has no entrepreneurial tradition at any period in its history. It has no overseas Russians like the Chinese have overseas Chinese from whom they can learn. So he has a huge problem in redoing his economy. And so far, frankly, if you separate what he has said from what he has done, not much has been done. If you go to Beijing, you see a lot of activity. When you go to Moscow, you do not yet see any evidence of perestroika. It still looks the same as it did 10 years ago. Now, maybe 2 years from now, we will see something. Now, that is the economic reality. Secondly, there's a political reality. As the Soviet Union looks around the world, it sees that every neighboring area, Japan, China, India, Europe, are all growing faster than it does. And therefore, its dilemma is, if it conducts an aggressive foreign policy, it will unite all these faster growing states against it. And so they have an incentive for moderation quite independent of whether Gorbachev is benign or not. And indeed, the biggest obstacle to making progress in negotiations with the Soviets are two. American sentimentality, the belief that everything depends on personal relations between people and that there are no objective reasons that lead to diplomacy. And second, the tendency of so many of our liberal community to think that the way you negotiate is to make concessions in advance to create a good feeling. The Soviets have two foreign policy choices. They can try to break out of this environment by knocking off some of these countries that are growing faster than they do. Or they can negotiate seriously. The more painful course is to negotiate seriously. Knocking off not necessarily militarily, but by pressure, by demoralization, by clever diplomacy, which is, in fact, what they're trying now in Europe and in China. Now, therefore, peace through strength is not just a slogan. It is a necessity. And what bothers me so deeply about Governor Dukakis is that I do not think he has any understanding of the forces that are at work. I have actually read, and there can't be many people in this country who can make this claim, almost everything he has said, everything that I could find that he has said about foreign policy in the last 20 to 25 years in his public career. I defy anybody to find me one statement about military capacity of the United States that is not deprecatory and sneering. There is nothing that we have done in any administration, including Democratic administrations, that he has ever approved. Because fundamentally, he thinks that American military power is a threat, that he has the radical view of the 60s, that America must be restrained from the exercise of its power. And this is why he, for example, as the only governor in the country, has prevented the Strategic Air Command from establishing secure communications links in Massachusetts. The only governor, they exist in every other state, with the argument that if we have secure communication links, we might be more likely to go to war. That incidentally also shows that he doesn't understand the problem, because if we want to initiate war, we don't need secure communication links. What we need secure communication links for is to prevent is to make clear to a potential aggressor that if we are attacked, we will not just fall apart and have the means of retaliation. That's what we need it for. Therefore, even think of last week's debate. Whenever he's asked about an American weapon, he says, the MX and the Midget Man, we do not need them, and we cannot afford them. Now, maybe he has a point, but it is a point that has eluded every other president since 1974 of both parties. The MX was, after all, proposed by President Ford, accepted by the then Congress, which was Democratic, continued by President Carter, continued again by President Reagan. So it cannot be a self-evident proposition that we don't need it and that we can't afford it. The Midget Man was put forward by a bipartisan group which included Senator Nunn and Senator and Congressman Aspin, the chairman of the Senate and House Armed Services Committees, who unanimously supported the Midget Man. Now, maybe we can't afford both, but all I'm saying is when we have a president who wants to get rid of the MX, the Midget Man, and the Strategic Defense Initiative, at the beginning of his term, for nothing, what are we going to negotiate with the Soviets about? I remember seeing President Carter on the day he gave up the B-1. That was an accident, but he told me proudly he had given up the B-1 bomber. I said, why did you do this? Tactfully. And he said, because now the Soviets are obliged to follow our example. Not at all. The Soviets do not pay for services already rendered. And he was still waiting for the Soviets to follow our example 4 years later when they left office. And so what is really at stake in this election is conceptions of American leadership, American power, and the relationship between American values and the conduct of foreign policy. What the Democratic Party, and I say this reluctantly because we need a bipartisan foreign policy, but unfortunately the radical wing, and there are many people in the Democratic Party, including their vice presidential candidate, in whose foreign policy views I have considerable confidence, but vice presidents don't run policy and in fact structurally have very little influence. The dominant view is that America has no right to exercise leadership, that it has to follow the consensus of the UN or of regional organizations. On that basis, nothing will ever happen, because unless America, as the strongest nation in the world, shows the direction, others will not follow us. That has been the whole experience of the post-war period. I've already spoken about American power, and then there's the issue of American values. Certainly, we have an obligation to stand by our values, but there's a dangerous view that until we are perfect at home, we have no right to do anything abroad, and that we therefore should put all our emphasis at home. And we don't have that choice. We have an opportunity now, with all these other countries gaining in strength, to achieve a real burden sharing, a burden sharing in which we do not ask for financial contributions to our efforts, but in which we induce them to accept their own responsibility for a larger share of not just of the financial effort, but of the intellectual and leadership effort. We have an opportunity to have serious negotiations with the Soviet Union in many areas of the world, Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere, provided we make it clear that there is a penalty for irresponsibility and that we know what we want. Now, there are a lot of people who sort of use, frankly, Gorbachev as a cop-out and say, let's just give him aid and he'll solve all our problems for us. I have never understood why a strong adversary is easier to negotiate with than a weak adversary. And I have to remember that Lenin said, the capitalists are going to give us the rope with which we will hang them. He didn't know the half of it. Some capitalists would like to give them credits to, so that they can buy the rope with which to hang them. So we need to put into some phase our commercial policy and our political policy. But my point is, all of this can be done. It can be done with the views of people like Senator Danforth. It can be done with a Republican president, the man like Vice President Bush, who has a great experience in foreign policy. It cannot possibly be done with Governor Dukakis, who will create chaos in our foreign policy and who will produce the exact opposite of what he's seeking. And I repeat, I do not normally, I have done a previous fundraiser for Senator Danforth, and I do not think he has heard me make so partisan a speech on that occasion. I simply explained the foreign policy situation as I saw it, and of course implied that, as I believe, that the Republicans are better able to take care of it. But this is a year in which really fundamental issues are involved. And at some point, we have to have that battle out and get a public expression on it, because otherwise we will always be torn between the situation that Senator Danforth described of endless resolutions in the Congress which tie the hands of a president who is the only nationally elected figure and who has certainly made his purposes clear. And this is why it's a privilege for me to come here, and I just want to say one personal word, which I've already mentioned with Senator Danforth. In 1975, which is quite a long time ago now, when Vietnam collapsed, it was a very, very painful experience for all of us who had inherited a war from a previous Democratic administration, had ended it what we thought honorably, and then had been thwarted by the Congress, which cut off economic aid and military aid. And then they collapsed. It collapsed. It was a very painful period. And I came to St. Louis on a speech that was scheduled for a long time. And I don't remember what I said. And what I said is totally irrelevant. But I have never forgotten the reception I received after an American disaster. And it said to me that out here, people want to stand with their government and they have confidence in their government. And it was a tremendous morale boost to me. And so that's another reason why I'm glad to be out here. Now I have about 10 minutes to answer questions. Thank you very much. Obviously, you can raise it about any topic of concern to you. Yes. I was a chairman of the Bipartisan Commission on Central America, a position for which there were not many applicants, including me, I can tell you. And that had such great supporters of the president on it as Lane Kirkland of the AFL-CIO, Bob Strauss, Mayor Cisneros before he distracted himself in other activities. And that commission made a unanimous report in an election year, according to which it was said that if Nicaragua remains in its present status as a dictatorial regime with an army of 100,000 and foreign advisors of 10,000, of whom half come from Cuba and the other half come from all over the communist world, that it would become an unbearable burden on all of its neighbors and that it could not be contained by the methods that worked in Europe because its neighbors were too weak and were too difficult to bring together. Therefore, we considered it imperative that there be a democratization of the government, a reduction of the armed forces, and a change in trade patterns so that they would be more in the traditional Western Hemisphere than become totally dependent on the Soviet Union. Soviet Union has given $2.5 billion worth of aid in this decade to Nicaragua, and about $500 million last year, of which $400 million was military aid. And here our Senate is debating whether it can give $37 million aid plus $3 million of humanitarian aid to the so-called Contras, who are better called freedom fighters. I think it was a disaster. And Speaker Wright says give peace a chance, as if you could separate a negotiation from the context. It is, after all, an interesting phenomenon. We achieved successful negotiations in Afghanistan, Angola, and Cambodia. In each of those countries, it was due to the fact that the local forces were at least equal to the communist forces and made it difficult for the communist forces and too expensive to continue on their course. Only 400 miles from our border did we not follow that principle because of our domestic divisions. And the fact is that since that time, the dictatorship in Nicaragua has gotten worse. And if you read the newspapers, you will find that in Salvador, that the guerrilla war has stepped up again, and that everything that was predicted unanimously by that bipartisan commission is coming true, and it is another self-inflicted wound on the United States. And the administration had the right perception and was not able to carry it through the Congress. Yes, sir.
Secretary, what do you think the long-term significance of the rumblings in the Balkan countries is, and what, if any, relationship or connection is that with the post-Dark and Glasnost?
I think that I was saying to the senator in the car coming over that I haven't made up my mind yet whether Gorbachev is a great statesman or whether he's one of these public relations geniuses who is adept in getting balls up into the air, but not so adept in pulling them down again. And he has started a whole series of events inside the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe that may be very difficult to control. Put yourself in the position of an East European who hears the leader of the Soviet Union make a speech at a party conference in which he says, no leader, not one leader in the whole history of this country has ever been legitimate or adequate. Stalin was the cult of personality, Khrushchev was an adventurist, and Brezhnev was responsible for stagnation. That neatly takes care of 70 years. Imagine if we said we have never had a president who's any good since Washington, what this would do to our system. Now, this is a system imposed from the outside. Secondly, all the tendencies I described in the Soviet economy are even more true in the East European economy, which is used as a sort of imperialist fiefdom by the Soviets, and where countries like Czechoslovakia know that before the war they had the standard of living of Switzerland, and now they're a backwater. And Poland has better resources than Italy and a very industrious population. There's no reason in the world why Poland cannot be as well off as Italy, except its system, and so you can go. There is no country in Eastern Europe that is satisfied with its present position. Now, I believe, in fact, that an opportunity may exist to begin re-talking about the future of Eastern Europe, because as the West European economic community develops, the attraction of it to the East Europeans will become nearly irresistible. And I think it is that I would focus the arms control negotiations not on this numbers game of how many divisions and how many tanks, but what security system are you going to have in Europe? Can you permit to have governments in Eastern Europe that are elected by the people and in which the Soviets do not claim the right of intervention, and at the same time maybe have a military status like Finland, which has some army, but has some assurances for security normally conceived in the Soviet Union. That would be an interesting negotiation. That would make a real contribution to peace. Now, what the Soviets are trying to do these days, we should watch. They have developed the concept of Europe from the Urals to the Atlantic, which means that they are part of the United Europe, and we are out of it. Now, that would first of all create a huge market from which we are excluded. And secondly, it would give them a military predominance in the whole area, which is another reason why we should do something about these East European negotiations. I think there is a possibility, and I sincerely believe that the next administration has an unusual opportunity to bring about a new international set of arrangements, provided it doesn't listen to some of these siren calls that have been put forward by our opposition. Yes, sir.
How far can China and Russia reach validation?
I asked a leading Chinese, and in July I was in China and I talked to a leading Chinese and I said, let me give you my theory of what is going on between you and the Russians. I said, you're doing less than our conservatives fear, but more than you tell us. And he said, well, let me tell you this, whatever we do, we will stop short of the world's record, which is held by Schulz and Shevardnadze. So, and it's not a bad description. They don't want to be the last Cold Warriors left on the barricades of the Cold War. On the other hand, they have a frontier of 3,000 miles with the Soviet Union. They know that frontier isn't going to get any shorter, no matter what they do. They are terrified of the Soviets, and frankly, they're terrified of the Japanese. And they want us as a counterweight, and they have always had the policy, inelegant as it may sound, of using the most distant barbarians against the closer barbarians, and that's us. So I think they will improve their relations with the Soviets, but I do not think they will improve their relations to a point where they risk their relationship with us. And the only way it could damage us is if we start getting frantic and either start getting insulting or start getting so nervous that it and start paying off, so that it looks that this is a good way to blackmail us. If we play it coolly and say, your independence must be worth more to you than to us, I think they will improve their relations, but stop well short of a point where we need a very squad. I'll take one more question. Yes, sir.
Dr. Kissinger, what advice would you give the Israeli government to solve the Palestinian uprising?
Well, first of all, I would say there is no such thing as a final solution of such a problem. I think the best that can be done with the on the West Bank is something that, like what was done in the Golden Heights in 74, where a arrangement was made that was called a military arrangement that has lasted 14 years and has kept the Golden Heights absolutely quiet for 14 years without terrorism and without any military action. If the Israeli government asked me for advice, I would tell them, stop playing domestic politics over here and get together and present us with a united position after their election, obviously, not before. Secondly, I think they have a dual problem. One is they cannot go back to the 67 borders, because if they do that, the corridor between their principal cities will be 8 miles between Haifa and Tel Aviv and 3 miles between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and they couldn't possibly survive that. On the other hand, they also cannot keep governing hostile Arabs that are not essential to their security. So a way should be found, in my view, by which they get rid of the largest number of Arabs that they can. Now, if you try to do that in the name of a final peace agreement in an international conference, they will assemble all their opponents in one place, and it will lead to a deadlock and to endless blackmail. I think the way to do it is in the direction that actually both Paris and Shamir have hinted, which is to be prepared to turn over to significant areas to, in the name of autonomy, I probably would need another name because that's become a dirty word, to begin self-government, say, in Gaza and other areas, and then invite Jordan and Egypt and maybe Saudi Arabia to discuss those arrangements, not as a final peace settlement, but as a means by which the Arabs in those areas can govern themselves in circumstances that contribute to the security of everybody. And my instinct is that if Jordan isn't asked to draw the final border, but to contribute to arrangements of self-government the king may play, and probably will play, because the last thing he wants, even less than the Israelis, is a terrorist state on its own borders. Now, you know, that's a very capsule statement of a very complicated situation, but I don't want to miss my plane. Thank you very much.
Senator Danforth and Secretary Kissinger, we thank you very much for being with us. Our Soviet delegation would like to have their picture taken with you, if we could, for just 1 second. Senator?